Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, award-winning writers Sigrid Nunez and Charlotte Wood discuss Nunez's 2020 novel, What Are You Going Through? This conversation originally took place September 24th, 2020, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Welcome, everyone, to this online program of the American Writers Museum. My name's Allison Sansoni, and I'm the program director here at the museum in Chicago, where we're now open. We're grateful to all of you for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. Tonight, we're really looking forward to hearing from a writer whose latest book was recently described by the New York Times as having a long conversation with someone who is telling you something important. Telling you something very important, but is telling it in a very quiet voice. You have to really pay attention. Be assured, however, that the experience will be worth it. Sigrid Nunez is the author of the novel Salvation City, The Last of Her Kind, A Feather on the Breath of God for Rowena, and the National Book Award winning The Friend, among others. She's also the author of Sempre Susan, a memoir of Susan Sontag. She has been the recipient of several awards, including a Whiting Award, the Rome Prize in Literature, and a Berlin Prize Fellowship. She lives in New York City. She's joined tonight by Charlotte Wood, who's the author of 6 novels and 2 books of nonfiction. Her 2016 novel, The Natural Way of Things, won the Stella Prize, the Indie Book of the Year, and Novel of the Year. Her 2020 book, The Weekend, is an international bestseller, shortlisted for the Stella Prize, and longlisted for the Miles Franklin Award. We're very happy to have you both here with us tonight. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Allison.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Okay, well, welcome everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. As you've heard, my name's Charlotte Wood, and I am coming to you from the coast just north of Sydney in Australia. It's just after 9:30 in the morning here. It's really just an absolute honour for me to be here talking with Sigrid Nunez tonight for you about her really profound and extraordinary novel, What Are You Going Through? And I'm a huge fan of Sigrid's work, so I leapt out of my skin when I was invited to have this conversation. I want to start, Sigrid, by asking you about... I've heard you say that this novel sort of grew out of The Friend, your previous novel, the National Book Award winner. I wondered if you could talk a little about how this happens, how one book sort of seeds another book. Is it a matter of following the voice, I wondered?
I think it's very much a matter of following the voice. And in fact, It wasn't planned. I didn't think, it's time to start a new book. I want it to be like The Friend. I want to have the same voice as The Friend. I want it to be, you know, to be something that seems to flow naturally out of that. However, when I did start writing it early on, I recognized that it was the same voice and the same tone as The Friend, but then I didn't think about it anymore. I mean, I just carried on. And you know, by the time it was finished, when I thought about the two books, I thought, well, this is certainly not a sequel, but the books are very similar. And I guess the most important thing would be that I felt that it is very much the same narrator. And that the way the narrator in What Are You Going Through sees the world and behaves and thinks about things and expresses herself are the way that the narrator of The Friend would also, even though they're not having the same experiences. You know, I mean, they are separate characters, but the same narrator to some extent, if you know what I mean, if that's possible.
Yeah, it's very much the similar sensibility, I guess.
Yes.
So the title, What Are You Going Through, which is also used in the epigraph for the book, is from the French philosopher Simone Weil. who's one of the things that Simone Weil is famous for saying is that attention is the rarest and purest form of generosity. And this, could you tell us about that statement that Simone Weil made, and how, at what point did you know that that was going to form sort of the spine of the book or the central idea of the book?
Well, I knew early on because I had this title from the beginning, and the title was taken from that quote, the love of our neighbor in all its fullness simply means being able to say, what are you going through? Which is one from one of her essays that I read in a collection called Waiting for God a really long time ago. And it always stayed with me. And, you know, so you could say in a sense that I began the book with something like that in my head. And then that was almost the inspiration for the book. And I don't know, I mean, to me, it just seemed to be a simple statement, perfectly expressed about something that, you know, that is absolutely true.
Simple but extremely morally complex. You know, asking the question is one thing, but listening to the answer is the point.
Right, what you quoted, you know, attention, the question of attention, and she had also has said that, you know, attention is a form of prayer as well. And then in this case, she's talking about attention that would be focused on some kind of work. I mean, not on listening to another person, but on doing some kind of work with full attention. Reading with full attention is a kind of prayer. Mm-hmm. So I was just very taken by that, and I thought that, you know, since she's talking about the love of our neighbor, what she really meant was, you know, people in general, strangers, basically, right. I had this idea to have a kind of chorus of voices. And, you know, some people have asked, well, why isn't there a question mark? There is in her, you know, in her essay, of course. But to me, it was like, it's not that kind of question. It's not like, what are you going through? Like, what's up? Or what's happening? I thought of it more of a statement, as in, I know you're going through something because you're a human being. Mm. So tell me, what are you going through? You know, it's not, it doesn't have to be even asked as a question. It's an assumption that you're going through something. And again, as you say, the implication is you don't just ask the question. The whole point is that you're asking it because you're actually going to listen with full attention to the answer. So another way of putting it would be, talk to me. I'm here, talk to me.
Well, there are lots of conversations through this book, some overheard, some had by the narrator. I want to talk about the response, the listening response that people give to people in pain. So one of the things, so our audience may know already that at the heart of this book is a friendship between the narrator and a very old friend. The old friend's cancer treatment has not worked, and she has asked the narrator to be with her through the last phase of her life. But another of the troubles that the friend is going through is a sort of fractured relationship with her daughter. I wondered if you could talk a little about that, and about how one of the difficulties for her is that people don't really believe the truth of her experience with her daughter. You know, they don't think that relationship is what she thinks it is.
It's true. It's, it didn't have to happen this way, but somehow it did happen this way, that in this particular case there's a mother and an only child who's a daughter, and the father has never been in the picture, and these two have never managed to get along, and there's always been this blame. The daughter has it fixed in her head that that her father would have loved her, that she's never even met her father, or that it's her mother's fault somehow that the father isn't there. And then the mother doesn't really know how to deal with the hostility of the girl while she's growing up. And so they just become more and more alienated from each other and are never able to repair things. They never heal. And this is one of those situations where other people don't want to believe that, you know, so they don't listen. I mean, they poo-poo it the way they people do so many things when it's the other person's problem. And they say, no, she loves you. All children love their mothers, they say. That so you can be assured of that. But it really isn't so. Her daughter does not have that kind of feeling. And then the narrator, you know, is always kind of chilled by the way her friend talks about her daughter, saying things like, well, you know, if I wish I'd had another child, which can be taken two ways. I wish I had a second child, or I wish I'd had a different child. And that's very painful. And also, you know, she says that she's always felt that there was something foreign about this child, that, you know, centuries ago, she would have believed that the child was a changeling. So I just wanted to explore that because I have seen that kind of thing in families, which is why the narrator says, you know, one of the most famous lines in 20th century literature is the beginning of Ford Madox Ford's The Good Soldier. This is the saddest story I have ever heard. And she says, I often think of that line, especially when I'm thinking about certain kind of troubled families, because it just, you know, it shouldn't be that way. Mm. Families should be happy, you know, and when there's this kind of lifelong trouble, it's tragic, really.
Mm. And that tussle also speaks to something that comes in later when the friend talks about being in a cancer support group and a woman, there's another story of another woman in the group who speaks about her marriage in a way that the people in the group can't accept in the same vein.
Yeah, it's very similar, in fact. I mean, yes, in that group, when it's all of the people in the group have cancer, it's a cancer support group. They're not all terminal like the narrator's friend. But she joins the group around the same time as another woman, and this woman tells her story, which is extremely sad, and you know, yet another saddest story I have ever heard, about her husband's response to her cancer, and it's everything that people don't want to hear in a situation like that, and it's everything that you don't know what to say to. But my narrator's friend is so upset by the fact that everyone tells this woman, you must be wrong. You're just seeing, and her children have also, and her grown children have also told her that. Everyone has told her that she's misreading this. She knows that she's not misreading it. And so what happens then, by not allowing her to have her real feelings, they're not supporting her at all. They're doing the very opposite. Mm. And, you know, and the narrator's friend who's there in the group, she feels so bad about this that she doesn't go back herself, because she feels so guilty. And she often thinks about it, and she wonders about it, you know, because that woman, you know, was terminal. And when she died, you know, whether she, you know, she just wonders whether anyone ever really listened or saw her before she died.
Which is such a
yes.
tragic thing to make her be so alone. So we're talking about some very sad things in this book, but one of the manifestations of your exceptional skill is the way that you're able to tell these very stark truths, I think, about some very painful things, and yet It never feels desolate or bleak or unrelenting. There's something about the way that you write that prevents a kind of miserable pall over all this very sad stuff. So one of the ways that I think you do this is through a kind of playfulness and a humour that is always through your writing. What does a sense of humour do for a writer, even if the material isn't funny?
Well, I think it's really for the reader. You know, when I teach, I try to explain to the students, you know, it's not about you, it's about the reader. And the writer has to be a seducer in a certain way. You're there to please the reader. You're there to give something to the reader. And to present something that was unrelentingly bleak and heavy and miserable and so on, I don't want to give that to the reader. I want the reader to have something else to be engaged by. In this particular case, I do early on say that one of the characters, the friend, who is the one who's dying, has always used humor to help her deal with difficult situations. And so I had to, I had to make some humor. And in other books where I haven't done that with a character, I've always wanted to have some kind of lightness in it. So that's also the way I think and see things. So so it comes naturally to me to include something like that. But particularly in this kind of situation, I think that you're writing about real life experience, and it just happens to be true that there is no experience that doesn't have some comic element to it. That's the way people are. Everyone will know what I'm talking about who's been going through this pandemic. How many funny things came to your inbox about the pandemic? How many really good jokes and memes and videos, all kinds of extremely funny things. Because if they hadn't come, we would have all been shocked, you know, because it's always part of things, no matter how grim. But as I say, I really do think about the reader and what the experience of reading is like. And I think that element of lightness and playfulness has to be there. And finally, I'll say that I do in this book, I do bring these two women together. They're hanging out together. And, when I hang out with my friends, we do laugh a lot. We do, I recognize my friends and myself in these situations that they're in, the kind of funny things that get said and the playfulness that you're talking about. It's always there. That's why I love my friends. I mean, it's just part of the way we see things and talk and socialize together. It's always there.
It's beautiful. Let's talk about animals for a second. You have animals in your work a lot of the time. That's very clear from obviously Apollo, the Great Dane in The Friend, and Leonard Wolf's marmoset monkey, Mitz, to the Airbnb cat in this book, which is also allowed its own story. It's one of the saddest stories I've ever heard. And the cat tells the story, which is just a kind of surprising and delightful leap made in the narrative, I think. Why are animals important to write about, and how do they carry meaning for humans, do you think?
Well, partly they give me the opportunity for that playfulness that you're talking about and for that lightness. Not everybody, but many, many, many people like to read about animals. And in a lot of the kinds of books that the kind of reader that I'm thinking of reads, that they don't get to do that. The animals are excluded. So anytime I read about a dog or somebody's somebody's friendship with a dog. I've always been delighted. I mean, Ackerley's My Dog Tulip is one of the greatest books I've ever read. A book I've read, you know, more than once. It just, you know, and that has, you know, has many admirers. But I just think, you know, that's me. I do love animals and always have, and kind of regret that I haven't had them more in my life and also in my fiction. I writing is a lot about observing things and then trying to describe them or explore them. And I love observing animals. I find animals fascinating. Beautiful, fascinating, incredibly interesting. And I discovered that lots and lots of other people share that. You know, I know that there are some people who don't like animals, for example, and I am not judging them, but I do find that very strange, you know, I just do. Only because they seem so likable to me. It's so lovable, and they're so you know, it just I mean, even, you know, just to watch like a documentary or something about that, and I you know, I think they're wonderful on the camera, you know, they're on screen, they're wonderful in on the page. So as I say, that's just you know, I'm glad that I actually, you know, decided that it could happen. You know, with the friend, I had always wanted to write a book that had an animal that was an important character, not one that was a narrator or but I did, and I felt it really had to be a dog, because that's the really special bond, that canine human bond. Now the cat in What Are You Going Through has a really small role. But I've discovered that, small as that role is, that has really captivated people. There isn't anyone, there are many things in the book that have not yet been mentioned, you know, anywhere, but the cat is never forgotten. And the cat seems to be really, you know, a little bit of a star, a scene stealer.
And it's also a lovely way of continuing this attention, right, to all things, not even just humans. I was really fascinated to hear you speak recently about what I think you referred to as your linear way of writing, that you start at page one and you write for, say, 20 pages, and then you would go back and revise that and revise it, and then go back to page 20 and write the next bit and then revise it. So is this returning a sort of generative process as well for the next bit, or is it purely about sort of perfecting what you've done already?
Well, I try to get that whatever section I'm working on, you know, as good as I possibly can before I move on, so that then as I go back each time, I make some changes. So, but it's always kind of a, you know, a polishing thing. I really have to have things very finished before I can move on. That's really part of it. And because of that, when the book is finished, it really is finished. I don't then go back and make all kinds of changes. And it's just what works for me, that kind of one foot in front of the other, and that kind of, you know, groping forward intuitively, because it means that everything that happens in the book comes out of what I've been living with for a long time before. You know, as opposed to the kind of writer who has to have the ending, has to have an outline, has to have certain kinds of notes about each character and that, and then kind of, you know, constructs it out of all these different parts. That would be very difficult for me. If for some reason, you know, somebody said, well, the next novel, you have to write it in this other way, it would be very, very hard for me. So this is my tried and true method. And it's what makes me feel most comfortable. Mm. It's so simple. It's part of the reason.
But so when you're doing the polishing, is it sort of a deepening as well, or is it purely about the language?
It could be. It could be some deepening, but it has a lot to do with improving the sentences, making everything more precise, and also having an idea. I might be at page 60, but then I go back to the first 10 pages as I'm moving along. I think of something that I hadn't thought of when I was writing them, or the first, or the second, third, fourth, fifth, whatever, 60th draft. But here suddenly I have, some image or something that I want to add. So it is a certain amount of revision. Mm-hmm. But the basic structure and ideas and what with and action or whatever, the basic elements are going to already be there before I move on. Or I might discover something that stands out as not true anymore, and I might take it out.
Interesting. I want to ask you about what seems, as when you're reading your work, a very natural sort of slide between reality and invention. I know the events of the book with the friend have not happened to you, and in the same way you didn't inherit a dog, for the book, The Friend. And yet, as I'm reading it, everything about the voice and the material just feels so absolutely true. It feels that there's no artifice whatsoever. How do you do this? How do you make it feel as if it's literally the truth of your experience on the page? Because there must be shaping and artifice that does happen.
Well, I'm a very good liar, I guess. I am, I guess. I can make things that are untrue sound very true. But to be more serious, there's another important reason. It's true that the books are written as if they were autofiction. I mean because they're not. It's true. They're absolutely not. They're what happens in them is completely made up. But I think that, I wrote my very first book like this, and that was published in 1995. So I've always had this in me. This has always been a way that I think, write, and feel. It's partly, of course, it's a first-person narrator, and I give that narrator certain things that I myself have. She's female, she writes, she teaches, she's my age, let's say. And then there isn't great distance between the narrator's sensibility and my own sensibility. So when I'm writing that, when I'm writing about the way she sees things and remembers things and maybe brings up a quote, a movie she saw. I mean, if the narrator brings up that she saw a movie, that's not invented. Mm. I saw that movie. And so there are these almost essayistic parts, and they're clearly, I think anyone would really know reading that the author saw the movie, not just the narrator. And when you see that happening many times, and it does, she says, at the end of such and such book, someone says, I wouldn't know that if I hadn't read the book. So if that happens often enough, that then when I come to a point and say that there's this dog in my house, you believe it because you believed the other things. Or in this case, I say my friend, I go to visit my friend in the hospital. Well, that doesn't sound very far-fetched. That sounds like something so likely. And then I think that that's another part of it. What I write about is very likely. It's the kind of experiences that we all have, as opposed to writing about something, very far-fetched, even if it's realistic. Mm. I think that's really why.
I think that's, and part of the reason the book affects people so strongly too, I think it's because we do recognize these experiences. It feels like I'm having this experience, which is a sign of great writing, obviously. Another thing you said recently is that you like to have a narrow frame, I think you said. You like not having too many choices when you're starting a book. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, again, it's a little bit like my method of writing, which is actually, you know, very straightforward and simple. You know, I have this idea that, you know, I'm always looking at someone's life in my books. And, you know, very often it's somebody in an extreme situation of some kind, you know, combat nurse in Vietnam, or somebody with a terminal illness, or someone who's lost both parents in a food pandemic. They're in extreme situations, but they're always ordinary people. I mean, they're not supermodels or presidents or, you know, anything like that. You know, I have this idea that if you look very, very closely at one life and in a certain way, you're writing about everyone's life. Mm. You know, so I want things to be narrowed down to a certain, you know, to kind of, you know, home in on something that can be about the wider world, but I don't want to include too many elements. You know, I want to be kind of economical, you know, almost in the way that poetry is. I don't want a lot of different scene making descriptive writing and lots of characters and events. I really just like to have that very narrow focus because, you know, I have this idea that, you know, I want to go deep rather than broad. And it is true that I feel that already if you're writing, you have too many options. I mean, you can start a book about absolutely anything. You can write it in any person. You can make it comic or tragic or have all kinds of things. I mean, you have incredible freedom to write about whatever. It can be autobiographical or completely fanciful. And I find that really overwhelming. And so I really just want to have something that allows me to be quiet and still with it and go deep with it rather than, you know, doing a great deal of research and and experimenting in all different ways and having, I mean, I have written books that have been, you know, much denser, like The Last of Her Kind, I have written books where I've had to do a lot of research, like writing about the nurse in Vietnam. And I loved that research. But again, even there, you know, it was about the war. It was about coming home from the war. It was about nursing, but it was about one woman's experience. And another woman observing her and thinking about her. So, you know, that's like, you know, imagine whatever I would try to write next, it would be the same thing. I would have the same idea about starting out like that.
I'm going to go to my last question, and it's a kind of big one. Do you know why you write?
You know, I write because I've always wanted to write for one thing since childhood. And that desire to write came from reading. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do what writers did that I read, storytelling, inventing things. But I also write because I feel when I do that I'm doing what I should be doing. It's me being me, and I recognize that from a really, really early age. And I, you know, if I'm not writing, I don't feel like myself. The writing, even though it can bring difficulties into your life, anything worth doing is hard. But it does make me happy. It does bring me a lot of pleasure. And you know, and something that I've said before, and that you know, I have heard, you know, people repeating it back to me and asking me about it, is that I really do believe that that writing is this wonderful way of being a part of the world and being out of the world at the same time. So, I mean, you're able to be solitary and just you and the work, which is something that I love, but you are also, you know, part of a community. You're always assuming somebody's reading you. So that, you know, that is why.
Look, we're going to have to wrap up, and I'm sorry, there's a couple of questions we didn't get to, but I just wanted to say that at the beginning of What Are You Going Through, there's an incredibly poignant line delivered by the man who gives the lecture about climate change. And he says that our only chance at redemption now lies in learning how to love and forgive one another as best we can, and to learn how to say goodbye. And I think there's probably no more summation of this majestic, beautiful book than those lines. And thank you so much, Sigrid, for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charlotte. I'm delighted to have had this conversation with you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, best-selling author Scott Turow discusses his recent novel, The Last Trial. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.